His name's Steve.
A full okay. hour of automotive mayhem with the real car guy, master technician, Mark Salem, where the only two things we can't fix is a broken heart and the crack of dawn. To talk to Mark, call 602-508-0960. That's 602-508-0960. Now, once again, here's Mark.
Well, good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock, my name is Mark Salem. For the next 2 hours, you're stuck with me. Unless, of course, you want to push a different button on your radio. But this is all about car show. This is a car show. Self-defense for car expense. So if you have a car question, car problem, it's easy. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. The first segment, though, we're going to talk about stuff I want to talk about. But this portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Larry Harker's Auto Repair at 38th Avenue and Indian School. He's been around since 1967, but Bob and Ellen are the two principals, and Ellen handles the front counter and the repair orders, and Bob handles the shop. He's really good. He's probably one of the best diagnosticians that I know. And he has this uncanny ability. Well, I don't know if it's uncanny ability. He has this drive that the car just challenges him, and he's not going to let the car win. So if you're anywhere near 38th Avenue and Indian School, I think you should be doing business with Larry Harker's Auto. However, no matter where you're at in the valley, if you've got the story that starts off with, nobody can fix my car, then call Larry Harker's Auto and maybe talk to Bob. Okay. You're not going to believe this story I'm going to tell you, but it's true. It's the truth. I swear to you. So a friend of mine is driving his Mercedes somewhere in Scottsdale. And he's probably on his phone, but I don't know that to be sure. And he hits a curb with the left front tire. Now, he knocks a piece of the wheel off, but the tire's still inflated. So he's still able to drive it. So he calls and he says, he actually was talking to my son. He said, I just hit a curb and I need a new tire and a new wheel and I need three airbags. And Alan says, what happened? And he goes, well, I'm just driving down the road. And he says, I just kind of hit a curb. And he says, hitting the curb was nothing compared to the three airbags popping that almost made me wet my pants. He said the curb hit on a 1 to 10 was a minus one. It was nothing. But the explosion of these three airbags, and they come out of the seat and they come out of the ceiling, so they're going to blow apart the leather stitching. And then he goes, and the next thing I know, I'm covered in white dust. And he says, there's yellow airbags in front of me, to the left of my head, and even to the back seat. He says, it's the most amazing crash I've ever been in. But he said, and I'm sitting there in the middle of the street, and I'm covered in white dust, and I just don't know what to do. So he says, I get out and look, and the tire's fine. And he says, well, he says, I'm just going to drive back home. Now, I bet he's got a 20-mile drive home. So he drives back home, and when he pulls onto his street, the story goes that there's lots of policemen there. So he pulls up, and he gets out, and he says, what's the matter? What's the matter? And they said, are you okay? And he goes, well, yeah, I'm okay. Why? And they said, well, Mercedes-Benz has been calling us, and they knew that your airbags deployed in another zip code. Then they saw you, the car moving, so they didn't know if somebody had stolen your car, or if they didn't know if you were unconscious and the car was driving without you. So they call the police, and the police are watching for him as he proceeds from Scottsdale to his house. And evidently they have police all along the path trying to find him. Well, it wouldn't have been hard to find him because he had all these big airbags on his head and on his shoulders and stuff. So this repair is going to be somewhere in the vicinity of $5,000-$6,000. And a lot of the airbags are within the seat and within the ceiling. So when you have an airbag blow out of the seat, then you have to open up the seat, put a new airbag in it, and then you have to stitch the seat back together. So there's processes for all of that kind of stuff. So he said to the policeman, they didn't say anything to me on my radio system. They didn't say, hey, are you okay? They didn't talk to me. He said, I had my radio on. So, folks, there's a lot of you that have that ability. You have the ability, and you're connected through your entertainment system to a satellite, and they're watching you. And they sell that service to you for this kind of an issue. When the airbags pop, we know it, and we'll send help. I suggest to you, when your airbags pop and you're in a crash, that there's five other people there with cell phones that are going to be calling. So I don't know that that's important, but I'll tell you what bothers me about this, and it's a privacy issue. It's just like the insurance company that tells you to plug this thing in under your dash. You have to understand that that little gizmo tells them everything about your driving habits. How hard you accelerate, how hard you brake, how fast you turn, what the speed limit is on the road, what your speed is. How many times do you hit the brakes lightly? How many times do you jam on the brakes? How fast you going? Everything about you. And so they know how to charge you for insurance based on your driving. So they know where you're at. And they know what the speed limit is on the road. So if the speed limit on the road is 45 and you're doing 61, even if it's in the middle of the night, that's a check against you. So I don't like the privacy part of that. I don't like somebody keeping track of me. I don't like somebody watching me drive. I don't even want them to know what radio station I'm on. And one of the things that we're seeing now is we're seeing the manufacturers come on your entertainment system and they say, good morning, Mr. Salem. How are you? Fine. Thank you very much for asking. Who the heck is this? Well, I'm your car maker. And I just noticed that you crossed over 5,000 miles and you're due for an oil change. And I know where you're at. And actually, I can make an appointment for you right now at this dealership that's 3 miles away. And I will guide you to their service drive if you want me to. So, obviously, the independent market, which I am part of, we're not real happy about this and them guiding you in. We're not happy that they know your mileage. We're not happy that some of that work is not going to be in our bays. But we think at the end of the day, it'll still be a quality and a price issue. So we're going to stick around and do what we can do. So that's what happens when you hit a curb with a Mercedes. But in the Mercedes defense, in order for you to blow the airbags, there has to be an instantaneous loss of speed, and then it's within 100 milliseconds, and that's a very short period of time. So, for instance, if you're driving along at 20 and he hits the curb and all of a sudden his speed in 100 milliseconds, his speed drops from 20 to 10. Depending on a lot of things, the airbags might pop. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It has a lot to do with what angle you hit, how much speed you lost, how fast were you going, how much speed did you lose. Now, you can have a soft crash where you go into a line of barrels on the freeway. And so you don't have an instantaneous loss of speed. You have a slow loss of speed. And people get upset because the airbag didn't deploy, and it's not supposed to deploy under those slow crash circumstances. But if you're driving along at 40 miles an hour and you hit an oak tree as wide as your car, you're coming to an instantaneous stop. And I can guarantee you, if the airbags are there, they're going to pop. All right. Customer complaints. It's no secret that everybody gets customer complaints, including me. So we had a customer, first-time customer, and he writes in a very public manner. He takes us to task. He says that he's disappointed in his visit. He came to me because of the radio and because he had recommended. I made an appointment on the phone, and they said they'd be open till 6. I got there, and they were closed. He says, I try to avoid leaving my car outside repair shops because thieves know how to get into the night drop to steal the keys. Folks, nothing could be further from the truth. All of us have steel doors. All of us have alarm systems. All of us have a way to where the keys go through the night drop and nobody with a coat hanger is going to be able to get your keys. I've been in business for 30 some years and I've never had anybody access my key drop, and I don't know anybody who ever has. So I'm in trouble because he thinks that night drops, the keys, people know how, the thieves know how to get into night drops. So he loses a lot of sleep. So it looks like he doesn't have any choice, so I dropped the car off after hours and kept my fingers crossed. You have to understand, somebody picked him up. So he didn't have to leave his car there. But aside from that, I'm already in trouble before I even wake up. So he also, on his note, this is what he says. I'm expressing my displeasure with the early closing, which was never, the note was never acknowledged. When you send a nastygram to us, we're not going to acknowledge your nastygram. Okay. So if you take us to task over something that has absolutely nothing in our world, then we're not going to do that. So he calls. To their credit, they evaluated the car quickly. The news was not good. He says the entire air conditioning had to be replaced. Folks, there's probably 20 or 30 items, and we only had 3 hard parts in that. So the entire air conditioning is a complete fallacy. We didn't say that. So now he's blown it into proportion. So the AC, the price was $2,350. Wow. Am I at least getting Ford parts? And here's where we get into a sideways deal that just goes crazy. He wants Ford parts, and we don't let customers dictate what parts we put in their car, and he wants a 3-year warranty. So he wants to dictate what parts, and he wants to dictate the warranty. At this point, we don't want him. He's never been in before. This is his first time. We don't want him. Say that again. So anyway, at the end of the day, I write him back, and I say to him, there's no such factory for Ford parts. Your fan belts are made by Continental Goodyear. Your battery's made by Johnson Controls. Your oil filter's made by Champ. Your alternator is made by Hitachi. And your mass airflow sensor is made by Denso. What else did I say? Oh, his fuel pump is built by Delphi, which is a spinoff of a General Motors product. And so it gets worse and worse and worse. And so he won't buy aftermarket parts. And we know that we can buy a Hitachi alternator for a lot less than Ford does it. And we know it's already a Hitachi alternator. In his case, it was a compressor.
1 minute.
So he's mad at us. And he says, I got a Google search and they have all kinds of compressors that have a 3-year warranty. Here's the difference, folks. The 3-year warranty doesn't come with the labor warranty, doesn't come with the diagnosis warranty, doesn't come with shop supplies, environmental charges, sales tax, and Freon. Otherwise, you take the compressor off, you send it away, 3 days later you get another one. But that's all that happens. You have to pay the labor again. You have to pay the Freon again. You have to pay the sales tax, the environmental charges, and all that stuff. Where all of us in the industry, when their compressor fails, your car comes back. We do it right then, right there. You don't pay a dime. So you want to wait 3 days? You want us to do it right then? You want to have the extra cost? So there's a difference there. That's all there is. It's up to you. I'm not telling you what to do. So he says he's going to pick up his car. We were very disinterested, and there was no interactions. Not exactly rude, but no conversation and no attempts to see if there was any way to please me. $48, please. That's what he says. We said $48, please. Okay, fine. I checked around and I filed for it, blah, blah, blah. So I said to him on this complaint that he put on the internet, I said, hey, if you go to Ford, I'll pay the difference. So if they're $200 cheaper than me, I'll give you $100. That's all there is to it. I said, but you're wrong about Ford parts. And I'll tell you something else about Ford parts you don't know. Ford has 2 boxes. They have a blue and white one, and then they have a red and white one. And there's a difference. Not much, but there's a difference. But there's a big difference in price. A blue and white one is the part that your car was built. And let's pretend that Mark Salem makes mass airflow sensors. So your mass airflow sensor goes down. That Mark Salem made that mass airflow sensor, so that's in the blue and white box. So it's exactly the part your car came from last year, last decade, 20 years ago. The red and white box is a mass airflow sensor from John Smith. Now, John Smith is now providing Ford their mass airflow sensors, but that's not what was on your car originally. So, red and white, blue and white, difference in price, but in reality, they're both made by the lowest bidder. That's all there is to it. They're both made by the lowest bidder. Here's one last thing. When you buy a house, Jeremy, give me the name of a house builder, just in the form of an example. Can you think of one? Okay, Jeremy's not talking to me this morning. If in fact, let's pretend it's ABC Homes. ABC Homes has a group of people that manage all the subcontractors. So there's a subcontractor that does the footings, the plumbing, the electrical, the roof, the drywall, the painting, the kitchen, the cabinets, everything else. So even though it's ABC Homes,
The only thing they do is they manage all the subcontractors. That's exactly what Ford is. Ford has nobody but subcontractors, and they put all those parts together, call it a Ford, and tell you it's the best they can do. But in spite of all of that, I'm going to remind you, Chevrolet, Ford, Toyota, Honda, Chrysler, your car is built by the lowest bidder. I don't care what you think. Everybody in our industry knows that to be a fact. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. I've got a caller, but real quick, let me finish the story. Okay, so we write back to this guy that's just all over us like a wet blanket. Hey, thank you, Jim, for your 2-star rating, but you're right, we aren't made for one another. Here's another side of the story. Our computers were down. We left a few minutes early. You didn't tell us you were bringing your car in. We didn't know you were bringing your car in, and we're sorry. You know that our computers were down because your work order that you picked up was handwritten, and we did leave 5 or 10 minutes earlier because we just didn't know you were coming. And since 1994, one customer car has been stolen and one was broken into, and both were left outside. Since 1994, we've had 2 cars messed with in our parking lot. So she goes through, my daughter's writing this, she goes through the stuff and tells him about his bid and all that stuff. We always overbid, blah, blah, blah. We have a 10% buffer. We're not replacing all your stuff. We're just replacing 3 components. And then she's a little snide and she says, make sure nobody charges you for the 17 ounces of Freon you already have in your system. We would not do that. So when we take it out 17, we put your 17 back. If you need 20, we add 3 more. We don't let the customer pick the parts for their cars. We sell millions of parts a year, and we know what's best for our customer. Yeah, we know about the parts on the internet. Yeah, we know about sometimes their price less. Well, we know about their warranty, but it doesn't really make any difference. 50% of the parts on the internet are returned as defective. We have that from major mouthpieces from the parts vendors. So what's happening is folks are taking the new part, they're trying it on their car, it doesn't fix their problem, they put it back in the box and they send it back as defective. 50% of the parts. Ask Rock Auto about that. So we don't want that part when we order a part. I don't want a part that's already been installed. I don't want a box that's all greasy. No part of your Mustang was built in a Ford factory. Your mass airflow sensor Hitachi, your alternator Denso, your belts Goodyear, your battery by Johnson Controls here in Arizona. Motorcraft oil filter was by Champ, your fuel pump was by Delphi, your brake pads are by Bendix. Blah, blah, blah. And so when you ask for new Ford parts, it makes no difference to us. It's just that you don't know what you're talking about. That's it. And we don't let you dictate the parts and dictate the warranty. You were nasty and unpleasant to my staff. We don't want customers demanding the parts and the warranties they want. So quite frankly, we're okay with you not coming back. Based on your reviews of other businesses, it's easy to tell you are hard to please. Boom! And he blows up about that. You look at his track record on Yelp. He has 5 entries, and 4 of them he's unhappy, and 1 of them he's happy. So I write that in there. So I got a 3-page letter that's single-spaced that takes me to task, and we hash this whole thing out, and he wants me to take that off there. Based on your reviews of other businesses, it's easy to tell that you are hard to please. So anyway, that's a day in Mark's life. So if you want to bill me for this psychology treatment or my psychiatric analysis, I'm okay with that. Jeremy?
Yes, sir?
Do you know what the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist is?
I am not sure. I know there is, but I don't know what it is.
Okay, the psychologist has typically a master's degree or a doctorate. But the psychiatrist has a medical degree. So in reality, I think narrowed that down is that the psychologist tries to fix your head bone by talking to you, and the psychiatrist tries to fix your head bone by giving you drugs. And I think that's it.
I think I'll just take the talk.
Yeah. Okay, Pat, thank you for holding as long as you did. Pat, how can I help you this morning?
Mark, I've got an early 1970s. Massey Ferguson 30B with a gasoline engine, and I could use a little advice from somebody who is older than my tractor.
Okay, that's fine.
The engine needs to come out for a rebuild. Got major compression loss on 2 out of 4 cylinders. And I know how to proceed there. The thing that concerns me about rebuilding this engine is there's cylinder sleeves in there. And I'm wondering, do I have any chance in my barn of removing those old sleeves and putting in new ones? Or should my first step be to find a machine shop?
I think the risk and reward of you trying to pull those sleeves and then reseal them and making sure that you don't have a coolant problem or a coolant leak, I think I think your chances are slim and none. I want you to know that's not something I would try myself. Here's what I want you to do. We have a machine shop that we believe walks on water. We have a guy there that's got gray hair. He has made things, he's fixed things that we didn't think he could fix. And I know he's capable of rebuilding motors because I often send him motors. So I send the motor in a long block style and, you know, he goes through everything. So I don't know the name of the shop, but I'm going to tell you to call my shop and ask for Jeff in parts. Jeff,
right.
And he's a good friend of Jeff's. And do you want to write down the phone number?
For your shop, I know your number.
Okay.
So,
call Jeff and ask the name of the shop. And then when you call the shop, you say, Salem Boys recommended you. And I would like very much to talk to you about this 4-cylinder Massey Ferguson with cylinder. You know, you may not need sleeves. You may have rings that are stuck. As he mics out the cylinders and the pistons and stuff, you may not need that. Or maybe you can get a 10,000th bigger piston, but he'll be able to help you. He'll be able to help you. If you have any other questions, stay right there. I'm about 8 seconds from the end of this segment. So we'll be back, folks, 602-508-0960. I'm Mark Salem. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. My name is Mark Salem, and we're here talking about cars, and we're going to do that in just 1 second. Kurtz Auto Repair is a shop that I recommend you try. If you're anywhere near I-17 and Bell, then Kurtz is on the northeast corner. He's a Better Business Bureau Ethic Award winner, and that says a whole lot. He opened his doors in 1987, and one of the criteria of the shops that are on my best car repair shops list is they got to have some gray-haired guys there. These aren't guys that opened up day before yesterday. These aren't a bunch of kids that decided to open up an auto repair shop, and they have seven tools between the five of them. That's not what it's all about. I'm sending you to guys like Kurtz that know what they're doing, have great customer service, and have great technicians that can diagnose and repair your cars. Again, Kurtz Auto, I-17 and Bell in Phoenix. Jim, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Hey, good morning there, Mark. How you doing?
Good, good. Thank you.
Good. Mark, I listen to you every morning. I hear your commercials when I listen to Mike Gallagher in the morning, and I love the sound of your voice. And they love your confidence. I don't have crack of dawn or a broken heart to fix, but my girlfriend does have a 2004 VW Jetta that has a air conditioning problem that she has tried to have fixed and plunked a lot of money into it and just not fixed. There were a lot of codes that were coming on, so many different codes. We brought it to a mechanic, actually. It was a mechanic in Mesa that had done some other work. It was the water pump, some of the timing that was supposedly fixed. The AC came on, but then it was shut back off. So we even had, it was the air compressor and then the double fan, replaced. AC would come on, it would blow very cold, and around maybe 5 minutes later, shut off. And now it doesn't even come on at all when my girlfriend takes it out. And in all honesty, Mark, because they're complaining, it's been hot, and so I said, I'm going to call Mark Salem and see what he can do with that.
We just had one of these, and actually in that particular car, what was happening was the fan was quit. And when the fan quit, then the high-pressure switch, the pressure on the high side would skyrocket, and when it gets up to like 350, 400, then it shuts the AC down. Mm-hmm. So we had the fan quit, then we shut the AC down, and we had hot air. So that was the 1, 2, 3. Now, in your particular case, the question really, I want you to have her monitor this. She's driving down the road and it's cold and everything's fine. And she shuts the air conditioning off, especially the fan blower.
And then I want her to turn the air conditioning back on, and I want her to take the switch, and I want her to work it kind of violently between 1 and 4. So whether it's a rotating switch or it's a vertical switch, I want her to do that. And I want her to take her right fist and hit the top of the dash. Because I think what's going on here, and I'm going to guess, I think the blower motor's bad. I think the blower motor's stopped running. And when we have battery power that goes through the switch and then feeds the blower motor, when the blower motor draws excessive electricity, it takes the switch with it. That's why I'm having her mess with the switch, and beating on the top of the dash might fire up that blower motor. Now, if I were you, the blower motor is going to be underneath the glove box, or it's going to be outside the car. If you can find it, then if she brings it home and it's not blowing cold, she doesn't shut it off. She runs in and she says, come out here, my hero. Get on your stallion. And you go out there with a hammer and you touch the blower motor and it ain't running. And you take your hammer, you hit the blower motor, boom, it comes on, cold air, boom, we're done. So that's what I want you to try.
Okay. And for a minute I thought you were joking, but it sounds like some of the back in the old days, what starter, whatever, you take hammers and just knock on them to get to kind of like unstick them. So it kind of sounds like the same thing in a sense.
No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. See, the fan speed 1, 2, and 3 go through a resistor, but fan speed 4 goes directly from the battery. So that's why I'm having her jiggle the switch, because if it works on 1, 2, or 3, but not on high where she's keeping it, then that tells me something. So if she bangs on the top of the dash and then all of a sudden it starts blowing cold, more than likely that fan switch is bad because the blower motor. So it's under those circumstances, we replace the blower motor and the fan switch. Now, another thing we could do is we could take a jumper wire straight from the battery to the blower motor. And we could bypass the switch altogether, and if she can put 5 days together with air conditioning, boom, we got it there too.
Fantastic. You know, I have a feeling that she's banging on the dash anyway and screaming a couple things to no avail because she hasn't juggled the switch back and forth. But no, that is fantastic, Mark. Thank you so much. She's listening on the other line. She's listening to the live, to the show. We'll try it and let you know. I'll call you back and let you know how it goes.
And she can always, email me or something, mark@salemboysauto.com, and we can talk about this. I think I can walk her through level 2 and level 3, at least where we can kind of determine. And here's another thing. You're driving down the road and we lose the air. And I hear that there's no volume problem. The problem is volume. There's just the air quits. And it's not that it turns warm. It just quits. Now, if it's going to come on, the question then begs to be answered. When the volume of air comes back on, I want to know if it's hot or cold. Because if it's cold, that means we got cold there. We don't have the air blowing across the evaporator. The evaporator is the big thing that gets cold. So when it comes back on, is the air immediately cold? That means that the compressor and all of that stuff is fine. It's the blower motor. And then at that point, I'd bet you double or nothing on the bill that the blower motor's the problem.
Okay. And, I wonder, as you're saying that, I wonder if there have been some times, in all honesty, that I don't know if it's necessarily every time that it shuts the air off completely with no warm or no hot, no cold air, or if it just turns warm. It's just that the almost like the cold just turns to warm. Would that be another condition?
Well,
the volume is there, but it's just not cold.
That's exactly right. It's something totally different. We've got an air conditioning compressor shutdown. So the question is, you already replaced the fans. So there's a high pressure switch and a low pressure switch, and that's about it.
Right.
So now the high pressure switch will just tell us what the problem is. We're not going to replace the high pressure switch. We're going to figure out the problem. And the low pressure is likewise the same. So either way, I think you know enough now that you and I can put this together. Okay?
Oh, right. Fantastic. Mark,
thank you.
Thank you so much. You bet. Really appreciate it.
Captain Ron, don't go anywhere because I got to take a break. But I'm going to take you first. And Captain Ron is a retired airline pilot.
And I want to tell you, I want him to tell you a story that I heard the other day that I thought was just something special. So in about 3 minutes, Captain Ron and I are going to have a conversation, and we'll be back right after this. Well, welcome back, everybody. Let's see what time it is. 46 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. And, you know, there's people out there that can't go get a CAT scan because they can't sit still in that big stupid tube that you're in. There's people out there that can't walk barefooted. There's people out there that are scared to death of doctors and needles. There's people out there that are scared to death of flying. So Captain Ron has a business called Fearless Flight. And what they do is they help people overcome their fear of flying. And I'm pretty sure it's not by tossing them out of the airplane with a parachute, right? Captain Ron?
That's the ultimate solution. We usually hold that in reserve.
Okay. All right, I need you to get close to your phone, and I can't be on Bluetooth because Jeremy's going to get mad at me. But how many people
do... Let me do it this way.
There you go. Better. Perfect. How many people, what percentage of folks do really have a terrible fear of flying and don't fly because of that fear?
You know, Mark, it's the numbers range because it's all self-reported. But, you know, back in 1981, Boeing Aircraft did a study. They said 18%. I would say that's still a pretty good number. You know, so you're looking, I figure conservatively, about 60 million people in the U.S. have a fear of flying that they alter their behavior for. So they either get freaked out on the airplane, I call them white knucklers, or they won't go. Those are avoiders.
Okay.
But yeah, it's really substantial.
All right. Now, when I board an airplane, usually there's a lady there and sometimes there's a pilot there greeting people. Can you see that person, that white knuckle person, when you're standing there greeting all the people that are boarding your airplane?
No, you really can't. Now, some people will open up to you, but because there's almost a greater sense of embarrassment that there is whatever they're afraid of, a lot of people will hide that. And you know, a lot of the people have this fear that they'll be exposed and embarrassed, you know, so they'll really internalize it. And I remind them that when you look around, you know, they say, well, everybody else seems to be doing okay. You know, why is it just me? And I say, well, it's just because they're just as good at hiding it as you are. So we really couldn't tell. But when I was toward the latter part of my career after 9/11, I'd always wanted to go back and talk to the people before we shut the door, and I did that. And it was the most, it was a career-changing thing for me. It changed the way I approached my job. But when we get within a couple minutes of closing the door, I would walk through the back of the airplane, stop multiple times on a 737, and I would just greet the people personally. And instead of using the PA, that's when I'd say, hey, we're going to LA today, you know, 35,000 feet, should be a smooth ride and all that. Because I knew after flying with people or working with people for 25 years that were afraid to fly, I knew that about 25% of them had some level of fear when they got on that airplane.
You know, I'm kind of an ornery guy, so it's a good thing that I wasn't a pilot, because I would have walked to the back of the airplane and grabbed a bottle of scotch that had some brown water in it, and I would have walked forward, and we would have had the whole plane disembarking. We would have had everybody just running out of there. So, okay.
Well, I didn't say that I did it with a straight face. I humor all the time. And you and I, you know, my dad used to say, full of pee and vinegar, you know. And when you and I have talked, when I brought my car in, you know, we've talked right on. I said, you are, you know, a fellow spirit there. But, yeah, I do use a lot of humor, you know, and I try not to terrify them. But I would make jokes that, you know, one day we got to the airplane and they had one of the access panels on the engine open up, and I don't know what they're doing, putting in oil or something like that. So I come through the gate there and I notice, you know, people looking out the window. And so when I got on there, the first thing I said is, how many of you are real crazy about getting on an airplane that they had the hood open on the engine? And, you know, and everybody looks at me with stark terror. I said, well, think about it. Would you rather get on the airplane not knowing there's something wrong, or would you like to get on one that they just fixed, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know what they did with it, but I don't care, because I got a logbook that they have to sign off. There's rules and regulations behind it, and the people that fix them are professional. And so I said, I'm right with you. I'm the first one to the scene of the accident, so I'm really interested in the outcome of this flight. Okay. And then, you know, there's a pause where they say, did he say he's the first one to the scene of the accident? You know, so, right. Yeah, so that's my version of drinking the brown water. But,
okay.
Yeah, humor helps.
Cover beginning to end of your career. You started when and you ended when?
Right over here in 1969, I went through Williams Air Force Base to get my undergraduate pilot training. I actually started at the Air Force Academy a few years before that. But I did my formal pilot training, got my Air Force wings over here in 1969, went to Vietnam for a year, came back and flew T-38s, which is the advanced trainer that the Air Force uses to teach its new pilots. And then I finished my stint in the Air Force as an instructor teaching the instructor pilots that would teach the new guys. And then when I got out, I went with Frontier Airlines up in Denver. They went bankrupt after about 9 years after I'd been there. Came down here to America West in the Valley and been a Valley resident ever since. And taking my cars over to have you fix them because I don't do cars.
All right. So my mother is just absolutely has a fear of flying.
Sure.
And so I call you up and I say, explain to me the process.
Okay. Well, if she lives, does she live in the Valley?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, well, perfect. So the first thing is just come out to one of the monthly classes that we have at the airport. Next one is a week from tonight at 4:30 at Sky Harbor, and they can just go to my website, fearlessflight.com, and you can register for it. It's free, it's fun, and that's the best way for somebody who lives locally here to do that. I do webinars online. You know what a great thing the internet is and a lot of this stuff. But the best thing would just bring her out and let her experience it. We're going to spend a little bit of time in a classroom and then a little bit of time on an actual airplane. So we cover both of those bases and we answer a lot of questions and we help people realize that what they really need is the confidence to know that when their anxiety comes up, they'll be able to get some tools and some strategies to cope with that. And once they do that, now the next flight they have is a better experience than the last one, and then they're off and running.
Okay, so you're going to take them through a classroom atmosphere, then you're going to walk them through an airplane.
Yep.
You're going to talk about the redundant systems. You're going to talk about that it can fly without one engine. You're going to talk about those
Absolutely.
Kinds of things. All right, but then
yep.
Are you going to just lock the doors and take off?
I don't think I'd be welcome at Southwest anymore. They trusted me not to do that. But it's funny you should say that because I actually have people say, "Now you're not going to move this thing." I said, "No." I said that'd get me and you in a lot of trouble. But no, the airplane is just static there. I do have a follow-on class, an advanced class, where we actually do. You know, people can hang in there, and we all buy a ticket together, and we go to. From Phoenix to somewhere in the LA area and back, like Burbank and back. And we got one of those coming up on September 16th. So,
okay, you're
yeah.
going with them, though. You're going to go with them. You're going to sit amongst them, and you're going to help them with their anxiety. They're going to take off Phoenix. They're going to go to Burbank. You're going to have lunch there. You're going to turn around, get on a different airplane with a different crew, and come back. And that kind
Absolutely.
Of process helps lots of people with anxieties about flying.
It does. People, I warn people. I say, if you fall asleep on the flight, I'm going to take a picture and I'm going to blackmail you. Because people can't believe in two flights that they can come back. And I accuse them. I said, you weren't really afraid to fly. You just wanted the doggone attention. But it really is. It's transformative. And that's, you know, we teach them how to get there. You know, we don't just drag them onto an airplane and shut the door and kidnap them. We help them lead up to that. So the class is part of it. And learning about redundancies, learning why it's so safe to fly, and learning why you don't have to worry about losing your mind.
Okay, now, the classroom and the boarding and looking around the airplane, that's free. You just got to go to Fearless.
That's totally free.
Fearlessflight.com and sign up. Then you're going to meet someplace in classroom, and then you're going to go out on the airplane and walk around and look at the galley and the bathrooms and the cockpit and where the pilots keep all their liquor, all that stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. We don't give them the key to the liquor cabinet, but
okay.
We will show them where we store it.
So yeah. Then the next step is, if they want to be a part of the next step, everybody meets at the airport, everybody gets on a plane, it's a short flight. How long is it from Phoenix to Burbank?
just a little over an hour.
Okay.
Just the right time to get them up, get them a little time at cruise.
Okay. Yeah. And now I would imagine you don't do that in the summertime when the plane is bouncing like a big ping pong ball through the heat, right?
We do it year round because I don't want my graduates going out there and trying to cherry pick all the flights that they don't think are going to have turbulence on them, because
okay.
You're going to have turbulence sooner or later. So okay. I want them to learn how to cope with that. Yep.
I used to go to California with a lady named Farzi, and we were both on the Ford Consumer Arbitration Board. And I was a technical advisor, and she was a Better Business Bureau arbitrator and a
uh-huh.
professional. And we'd come home during the turbulent time in the afternoon, and I can remember blood running off my arm. She's holding on to my arm and the armrest, and she's just, her veins in her neck are sticking out, and she got better, but it was just, there was nothing I could do other than just hold her hand or let her hold mine.
Yeah.
But when she used to say this, Mark, she says, when the wings start flapping, I don't know, I just get kind of nervous. And anyway.
Yeah.
All righty, Captain Ron, thank you for spending this time with me. Folks, I want to say again, fearlessflight.com. And if you want to talk to Captain Ron, then it's Captain Ron at, oh, and Captain is just the four letters, C-A-P-T. It's the abbreviation for Captain. Captain Ron at fearlessflight.com. He's a good guy. Got to sit in my lobby with him not too long ago and talk about this. And he's pretty adamant that his success rate, and I believe him, is something that's abnormal, because he's just a guy that just talks about the airplane, and you know he knows what he's talking about. You know he knows, when you ask him a question, he's going to tell you the truth. So if you do have a fear of flying, then may I suggest fearlessflight.com. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Automatic Transmission Exchange. If you go down Washington Street, anywhere near 40th Street, and you look on the north side of the road, you'll see a sign there that says ATE, Automatic Transmission Exchange. They've been around since 1968. 1968, I hadn't even graduated high school then. So these guys have been around a very long time. They rebuild transmissions. They repair transmissions. They do transfer cases. They do all kinds of that kind of stuff, and they do a good job at it. So if you're in the Central Phoenix area and you want someone to take a ride with you and you can duplicate the transmission problem, may I suggest that Automatic Transmission Exchange would be the place that you go. Now, we're going to change pads, and we're going to talk about North Scottsdale. Air Park Auto Service is owned and operated by Nadine. Nadine is a lady. She's been around the block a few times, and very few technicians and people are going to be able to BS Nadine. Nadine has been in the air park since 1985. She's on Raintree just east of Hayden, and that's about three or four blocks south of Frank Lloyd Wright. They've been on my best car repair shops list for years, and they're a state-of-the-art clean and green facility. They have just about everything you'd want. That's Air Park Auto in Scottsdale.
Well, welcome back, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock. Let me tell you what happens behind the scenes. Okay, I'm supposed to be out on the second at 58:50. So 10 minutes of 59 minutes. So it's 58:50. There is no excuse to miss that number. There's no excuse. We are all professionals. We're supposed to hit our marks. Now, at 17, I'm supposed to take a break, and that's kind of a fluffy break. I can mess around with that. I can be a minute or 2 minutes or 3 minutes one way or the other. 30, it's hit the dog on the nose. Not 29:20, not 29:28, not 29:48. Talk until 30. 40 is a flexible one, but 58:50 is out. In my head, I'm not in studio right now, but in my head, I know Jeremy is just white-knuckled, and his eyes are on the clock, and his finger is ready to push the button, and I'm looking at my clock, and I already know our clocks are synchronized because we do that before the show. So I'm looking, and it's 42, 43. I'm still talking, 44, 45. And I'm Mark Salem. This is Kate. See you in a minute. Bingo. I hit it. So I know he's sweating bullets, and I hit that last break right on the money. And I said, were you worried? And he goes, yes, I was. No one's really going to know But we're still supposed to do that. So anyway, let me tell you about it. Oh, first of all, let me give you the phone number, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. If you have any kind of car question about fluids, about filters, about air conditioning problems, about aftermarket warranties, about who should fix this car, do I have a suggestion for somebody that does this kind of work? Any of those are not, everything's on limits. Everything's okay. The only thing we're not going to do is we're not going to talk bad about anybody, okay? So if you've got a heartburn on somebody, then just leave it to another show. This portion of it, of this show is brought to you by S&S Tire and Auto Service. They opened up in 1976. They have three locations that serve the West Valley: Peoria, Surprise, and Goodyear. Here's what they have that few other tire facilities have. You pull your car in, they'll look at your tire size and the load rating and the speed rating. Then you can say to them, I want a good, better, best price. Now, this is a price that you can write your check before you leave home, because this is the number they're going to give you. So you can look at them and say, okay, well, you know, the four of the good is this much, the four is the better is this much, and the four of the best is this much. And you can decide. If you're going to turn the car back in on a lease, you might want to go with the good. On the other hand, if it's a car you're going to keep for the next 10 years and your wife drives it and you got kids, then maybe it's the best, but that's your choice. So if you're looking for new tires on anything, from wheelbarrow tires to tractors and everything in between, S&S Tire would be a great place to start in the West Valley. All righty, let's see what else we've got while we're waiting for calls. I got an email the other day from a friend of mine, and this is the software for Mercedes-Benz, okay? The new software, there's two levels of software. The first level, which is called Kit 3, is $17,062.94, and that's what it costs you for the gizmo. That's what it costs you for the interface. That's what it costs you to talk to the car. And then it's $8,000 a year. So the shop... And this is an independent shop. The independent shop spends $17,000 for the hardware, and then he pays $8,000 annually a year to use the software and the hardware. So that's kind of expensive, but it's not nearly as expensive as the next level, which is $24,369 to buy the software and the hardware, and then it's $8,000 a year. And you get a couple of updates. Now, those are kind of steep prices, but all of us have those costs associated. So we all have scanners. We all have to pay for software. We all have to pay for annual fees or something like that. And part of that has to do with that the manufacturers want to drive business to their facilities. And so the diagnostic tools to the independent shops are often quite different with respect to annual fees and initial cost fees, because that's just the way it is. So it's not that the independents are going to be more money, because in fact, I think everyone would agree, generally speaking, certainly 75% of the time, the average independent shop is going to be less per hour than the dealer is. And let me tell you about that per hour thing. The other day I was talking to a shop owner, and he said that he had a kind of a loud altercation with one of his customers, and it was about labor rate. And the customer took 4 or 5 minutes of his time to berate him about his labor rate. And he said to the customer, you're wrong about the labor rate being important. You need to be worried about the hours. And he said, because I can have the cheapest labor rate in town and charge you 4 hours, and he can have the most expensive and charge you 2.5. So it all kind of comes out under those circumstances. So you're not really going to focus on the hourly rate. You should focus on the hours. So if somebody bids your air conditioning compressor at 4.1 and somebody else bids it at 3.6, then there's a half an hour difference. Well, that half an hour should be comparable to their two different labor rates, and a lot of times it's not. So there's people on both sides of the issue, dealers and independents, that kind of play with those numbers. So it's not a bad idea to do some shopping. I don't think it's worth your time to go down to the pennies. And I think you should deal with somebody you're comfortable with, no matter who they are. So if you're comfortable with the dealer, then stay there.
Here's the problem in our industry. This is the problem. It's a big problem. Is your owner's manual, and you can take this to the bank. Your owner's manual is written from Minnesota to Death Valley, from the New England area, the New York area, the Great Lakes area that gets snow, the Montana area, the North Dakota area, all those places that go below zero and all that jazz. Your owner's manual in your car is written for them and Death Valley and Arizona and I-10 and Phoenix. So there's a lot of things that are being sold that have fancy names to them. Like, I want to flush your upper intake. I want to clean your throttle blades. I want to clean your and reset your idle air control motor. Here's the problem. The problem is none of those appear in your owner's manual, and all of them have symptoms. They all have symptoms associated with your need. So when you have a throttle, dirty throttle blades, you're going to have an erratic idle. Maybe the car will even die and stall, but it'll restart immediately. Intermittently, it'll die or stall. But when you turn on your air conditioning, it may have a stumble for about 5 or 6 seconds, and then it smooths out. So there are specific symptoms when you flush the upper intake, when you clean up the throttle blades, when you clean up the idle air control motor. So my advice to you is learn how to say this. No matter who the shop is, mine included, when they offer you a service that starts at $129 and goes to $295, and they say, this is something you need. Flush your brake fluid. Flush your power steering fluid. Flush your transmission. And all this chemical stuff that goes on with your engine. We want to drain your oil and put a chemical in there. We're going to run the engine for, you know, an hour. And then we're going to drain it all out. And your engine's going to be as clean as it was at the beginning. Here's what you need to do. When they offer that to you, ask them to put it in writing and initial it. And then ask them, what symptom do I have that you're going to fix? And I want to tell you something, that one question will, and looking in their eyes, that one question and watching their facial features will tell you all you need to know. Because they'll start babbling and they'll not know how to handle that. And they'll start talking about your owner's manual and Aunt Mary and they just saw a car the other day. And that's not an answer to your question. So if I say, Mrs. Jones, you need a brake fluid flush, and Mrs. Jones says, what symptom are you going to correct with your brake system flush? And I'm going to say, step out here, and I have this device, and watch now. I'm going to stick this device in a brand new quart of brake fluid, and you'll notice the moisture content is about 0.5. Now, I'm going to walk over to your car, and I'm going to stick this same device in your brake fluid, and you'll notice your brake moisture is 3.5. We don't want water in your brake fluid, so I'm suggesting you
call her Felix.
Here is the amount to do it. It's not something you have to have done today. This is not something that's going to cause your car to quit running, nor is this a safety issue, but it is something that you should have done, in my opinion. That's the way. That's how it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be able to pull a show and tell for you. And not a show and tell that sounds like you're 8 years, 10 years old. It's, this is why I'm doing it. This is the symptom I'm going to fix. That's what it's all about. Felix, good morning. How can I help you this morning?
Hey, I've got a question. As you know, I got a Tundra 2005, and it's a sealed transmission. And there's no stated time in the owner's manual when you're supposed to flush that out. I flushed it out at like 80,000, and right now the truck's got like 105 grand on it. What do you recommend to these sealed transmissions? As we all know that the fluid should be changed at some point in time.
Well, how did you flush it?
Took it down to the guys up here, and they did a total flush on the thing to a repair shop here in Payson.
Okay, but you don't know how they did that.
They put in some kind of cleaner and so on to totally flush it before they put the new, I took it to Fletcher's up the street there.
Okay, I understand that, Felix, but here's what I'm saying. Okay. You can't have a sealed transmission and then have a flush. They work against one another. Now, what I wanted to hear was, is that there is a procedure that you must go through.
Correct. That's what they did. That's what they did, Mark, a procedure.
All right. Uh-huh. So most of the time we interrupt the cooler lines going to the radiator and we hook our flush machine in there. I'm not quite sure. Well, I'm sure. We've never used a chemical. I'm not big on those kinds of chemicals. As far as you did it at 80,000? Was that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, 80.
Mm-hmm. All right. I would do it at 160. Is that 80? Okay. Is 80 your first one?
Yeah, 80 was the first one. And again, like I say, there's nothing in the owner's manual that says you're ever supposed to do this, period.
Well, and they, when they say sealed transmissions, they're telling us they're sealed. They're telling us they don't want us to mess with it. However, they create the service procedure to do it. So they're kind of talking out of both sides of their mouth. I agree with you that the fluid condition is what drives the need. So it's like last week, you had a guy taking his big trailer and he was backing it into a spot and the transmission burped a bunch of fluid out of the dipstick tube. Well, he just overheated the transmission. At that point, I need to change that fluid. So, but in your particular case, the question was, is when should I do it again? And the answer is after another 80,000 miles on top of the first 80, and that's what I would do if I were you. All righty.
Great. Good. Thanks a lot, Mark.
All righty. Thank you,
Bye.
Felix. Action Auto Repairs up on I-17 in DeValley. They're a good shop. I've known Tom, I'm pretty sure, since 1979. Now, he's been in business since 1983. It's a family-owned auto repair shop. He served Deer Valley in the North Phoenix area since he opened in 1983. So whatever your repair needs are, he has ASE Master Certified Technicians. They know how to diagnose and get the job done right. Then they test drive it to make sure the symptoms are gone, and that's what it's all about. Action Auto Repair is capable of helping you make the best decision for you. And the one question you ask him and everybody else is, this a safety issue? Because I need to be concerned. The Action Auto Repair, I-17 in Deer Valley, will be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Mark Salem. Every Saturday we're here talking about car repair, and you're always welcome to join us. I know we've got Roger on the line, so we're going to go to Roger, but let me give you the phone number real quick, 602-508-0960. You're welcome to join us. Any car question, what kind of car should I buy, what kind of tires does Mark have on his wife's car? First of all, Mark, do you love your wife? And then second of all, what kind of tires do you have on her car? Those two questions go together, if you know what I mean. Roger, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Mark, let's start from the rear forward under the hood. I have a radiator. This is a 2006 Toyota Tundra V6. I have a radiator. Then in front of that is another, what looks like a large radiator, which I guess is the condenser. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
All right. And forward of that, I have a small unit that I assume is the transmission cooler or radiator.
It's a
whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
I'm sorry, say again?
It's going to be a transmission cooler, or if the cooler lines go through one of the tanks on the radiator, I can't tell you for sure, but that could also be a power steering fluid cooler. So it's either transmission or power.
What it is. Okay. What I'm thinking is, it doesn't look, all right, let's say I'm sitting in some heat on 17 for 4 hours. And I'm not moving forward at all. My transmission, I'm sitting there in neutral or park with the air conditioner on. There's no air going through any of these things to the transmission or anything else to keep things cool except the fan. Would it make any sense to increase the size of that small cooler in front of all that, or put a manual fan on it? Or what is best when you're sitting in that kind of heat in the sun, for the transmission to stay cool, should I be in park, neutral, should I put a fan on it, should I increase the size of it? What do you do with that?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the temperature gauge of the engine tells you the temperature of everything. So, yeah. So if your temperature gauge, you know how you have goal posts in your temperature gauge, and so you have a left goal post and a right goal post, and then on the other side of the right goal post you have a red area, okay? As long as you're within the goal post and you're sitting there and you got your air on and it's in the middle or it's at the 3/4 mark, then the transmission fluid goes through the radiator or it goes through the cooler. your fan is moving air because you have a big shroud. And the fan has some pretty aggressive blades, and if you want to figure that out, turn it on an idle, take a piece of tissue and drop it down in the grill, and you'll see that piece of tissue head towards the radiator or the condenser in your case. So, and the power steering fluid, the transmission fluid, the engine oil, it is all the same temperature as the temperature of the coolant in the engine. So I think your concerns about the transmission fluid overheating or power steering fluid overheating, depending on which one that little cooler is, I don't think they're valid. I think you'll be just fine watching your temperature gauge, and that's what I would do, is just watch my temperature gauges. That's it.
So is it better to be in neutral or park?
It makes no difference. The transmission doesn't know the difference. Now, sitting there with your foot on the brake and in drive is going to cause some additional heat in the transmission because we're driving, but we're foot's on the brake. So I think if I were you, I would be in neutral or park, depending on if I'm on the downhill slide on 17 and I can just take my foot off the brake and it's moving at walking speed and I don't have to go into a gear. I'm just going to leave it in neutral and kind of stop when the car in front of me stops and so forth and so on. If you're going on the uphill side, then you're going to have to put it in drive. But yes, the answer is given all the choices, park, neutral, or drive, I'd much rather you be park and neutral. All righty.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome, Roger. Thank you very much. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. I was looking at a new thing the other day that's a card, and it has 10 different dots on it. And what you do is you take this card and you put a dab of brake fluid, power steering, engine oil, coolant, differential oil, transfer case oil, But anyway, each one of you take a dab of this fluid and you put it on the white dot, but to the left of the white dot is an okay, and then a green, and then a red, or something like that. So basically what you're doing is you're comparing the color of this fluid sample to these other three dots, and then if it's like dot number one, it's okay. If it's like dot two, it's green, it's okay. But if the color is like dot three, it's red, then you need to have that dealt with. I've ordered some of these, and I'm going to experiment with these. I need to be comfortable with these. And I do like the idea that the fluid color means a lot to those of us that are experts in that field. And I do agree. Oh, it's got diesel oil as well. And that's the one I'm really concerned about, because diesel oil, when you change the oil in a diesel, you put a nice amber-colored oil in the diesel. And within the first 5 miles, that oil's black. I don't care. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Mr. Dodge or Mr. Ford. If you drive a diesel for 5 minutes or 5 miles after an oil change, the engine oil's black. So I'm not quite sure about that diesel oil and analyzation with respect to color. I don't know how that's going to work. And another issue is brake fluid, and I'll give you an example. Brake fluid has a moisture content, and that's the parameters I choose to use. But we have brake fluid that's white and clear. We have brake fluid that looks like very diluted iced tea. We have brake fluid that looks like normal iced tea. And then we have brake fluid that looks very dark, similar to a diluted chocolate milk. There's a lot of us that argue about when we serve your brake fluid. When do we change it? And a lot of times, if you have it in the third level, where it's kind of iced tea, after you flush it, we can't get all the trash out of a closed system. So a lot of times, you go from kind of dirty, kind of clean, and then you go back to kind of dirty. And I don't know the customer's going to like that. So those are the kinds of things that I struggle with. I think our industry struggles with that. So I'm going to try this and just see what happens. I'm not going to create any sales out of it. I'm just going to have our technicians do these, and then we're going to have a big get-together and figure out amongst ourselves what the heck we're going to do.
Jeremy, what was the name of the next caller that I'm not going to be able to get this
right? Sam.
Sam, if you'd please hold on, I'd appreciate it. We're up against a break at 30 minutes after the hour, and I'll take you first, I promise. So if you stay there, if anybody else would like to join us, there's four lines open, 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. To make sure that Jeremy knows I'm going to hit the spot, I'm going to count it down. 8960.
Got it. If you find yourself agreeing with everything Mark says, please seek professional help.
Oh, boy. Jeremy, when I get my hands around your neck, you're going to be sorry. But that's very funny, and I don't mind that at all. 602-508-0960. Sam and Terry, you stay right there, because in about a minute and a half, I'm going straight to you. This portion of On the Hood is brought to you by Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing in Mesa. He's the only shop in Mesa that's on my best car repair shops list. Since 1970, they've been providing expert auto repair, and they do light truck maintenance, they do diagnostic and repair, they do air conditioning, they do lots of stuff. They have ASC certified technicians, and they're also going to prompt you when you are due for some of the services they've already done. So if you got a transmission fluid change, they know that 1 year you need to have one, so you're likely to get a card. Low pressure, just it's time. That's all you need. Thompson's Auto Repair is on Main Street, just east of Stapley. Main Street, east of Stapley, centrally located, Thompson's Auto Repair. Sam, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Hi. I've got a 2005 Toyota Highlander.
Okay.
I just had the spark plugs changed and the coil boost, I guess.
Yep.
And it just doesn't seem like it's peppy. It's not running bad, but is there anything you can do to make them run zippier or peppier?
How many miles are on it?
150,000.
Okay. And the change, was there a noticeable change or no noticeable change between before and after the spark plugs and the boots?
I guess maybe very little.
Okay.
A subtle change.
All right. And am I safe in saying that it idles smooth every time you come to a stop? It idles smooth in the morning when the engine's cold. It idles smooth and hot when the engine's hot. It idles smooth when you're stuck in traffic and you're in drive and your foot's on the brake. Can I assume that?
Yes, it idles smooth.
Okay. And see, what I was fishing for there is my guys have done spark plugs and boots, and sometimes, not very often, but we mess that up. And so we're going to give them an engine miss, and that's going to obviously make a difference in the power and the performance and the quality of the idle. So what I was fishing for is I wonder if they made a mistake on the plugs or the coils or the boots. So you have what they call coil over ignition. There's a coil sitting on top, then there's this rubber boot that goes from the coil to the top of the spark plug. So you don't have a distributor, you just have that. You can't really advance the timing, which is what we used to do in the old days. It's not likely that you have an exhaust that's plugged up. You have new spark plugs, and that's really about all you can do. Now, you could go have some custom exhaust put on there. You're still going to have a catalytic converter, but they can open up the tailpipe after that. That's going to give you a noticeable difference, but there's 50% of the people said it's not worth what I spent, and 50% of the people said it is. Now, I also need to make sure that somebody didn't put 30 weight in your engine and it calls for 0-20. And then you also need to make sure that your tires are fully inflated and that they're appropriate. But other than that, maybe cleaning up the throttle blades might give you a little bit more power and performance. But let me ask you this. Are you
a, no,
say that again?
Go ahead. I was going to say there's no kind of chip or anything you can do like that to enhance the performance?
Yeah, your 2005, I'd get on the internet and I'd use the word chip. I'd use performance enhancer. I would use software, and that's, you know, you're gonna Google all that for Highlander. Programmer, that's a programmer and chip are the two words you're gonna kind of look for. Most of the time, if they make one, you're gonna have some options. I would suggest that you go option one. Or you're at option one now, and so I would suggest you go to two, and then you go to three, and then when you get to four, you're going to say, ooh, I don't like it here, and then you'll back down to three, and you'll be really happy, and that's what you're supposed to do.
So yes, you could get a performance, you could get a chip, or you could get a programmer, and you could change some of the parameters to give you a little bit more pep. Now, here's the bad news. The bad news is we can't give you more power without using more fuel. So you're going to sacrifice a little bit of fuel economy for a little bit of power. All right?
Okay. Well, if I'm getting 21, I might get 19.
No, if you're getting 21, you might get 20 and a half or 20 and a quarter. You're not going to lose an obvious amount. You're not going to lose any more than you would if you're okay. going to Payson and back and you're climbing hills.
Okay.
So.
All right.
Okay. Good luck to
That's
you.
That's good. All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome, Sam. Thank you very much. Terry, you're up next. Terry, how can I help you?
Well, most people tell me I'm beyond help, but that's a different story.
You and me
I've
both.
I've got a 19. Yeah, I think I told you, Springer, I had a 1967, but actually it's 1987 Buick Century Station Wagon. And when it gets below a half a tank, it'll stall out on me often. I mean, it'll stall out on me in the middle of an intersection when I make a left-hand turn. A little scary. I've told the guy who I have as a mechanic that I think it's just a fuel pump, and he's saying he doesn't think so, and I don't know if he just doesn't want to do it or what, but it sure sounds like it's a fuel pump to me. What else in the world could it be?
Like I said,
when it gets below a half a tank, it'll start stalling once in a while, but if it gets down to where there's only a quarter of it left, I mean, it'll stall all the time.
Okay. All right, I'm going to put you on hold. I got to do my break.
Okay.
And when we come back, I'm going to answer your question because I do have an answer for your question. 602-508-0960. Jeremy's flying the airplane. You can say hello to Jeremy. Jeremy just got out of jail not too long ago, and I'm not quite sure if he was taking money out of the plate at the church or if he was caught driving backwards down Central. I'm not quite sure, but I'll do the best I can to find that out. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Mark Salem here every Saturday from 10 to noon, and we're going to finish up real quick with Terry, who had an 87 Buick station wagon, a Century Buick station wagon, and it appears that when the gasoline gauge gets about halfway, then he suffers from starvation problems where the engine dies. And the lower the fuel level goes in the tank, the more obvious and the more common and the more often this thing happens. How's that? Is that a good synopsis of what you said?
Boy, you said that great. You must have done this before.
All right. Yeah. The fuel pump needs to be lubricated and cooled by the gasoline. And so we've got the fuel pump laying pretty deep in the tank because we can't have it out there in Never Never Land when it's at a quarter tank because a lot of people stick around quarter. I think what might be going on is, yes, it could be the fuel pump, but attached to the fuel pump is the sending unit that talks to the gauge. And if the float at the end of the sending unit is filled with gas, then it's never going to read right, and you are going to get into critical stages. One way or another, the tank has to come down. How many miles on your 87?
70,000.
Okay, ever had the fuel pump changed?
I haven't.
Okay.
The previous owner, I don't know.
Okay. Chances that it hasn't been changed, but you still got to pull the tank down. So I'd run it as low as I could, find a shop that's not scared of your car. And I think once you get the tank down, I think your answer is going to be inside there. It's either going to be the pump, and there's a little rubber hose that goes from the pump to the feed line. And how old is your car? 23 years old? Is my math right? 23?
Well, 67? No, it's more than that.
Okay.
30, 40, almost 50 years old.
Okay.
My goodness sake.
So,
it's an antique. It's
it is. It is. I thought you said it was an 87. Is it a 67?
No, it's an 87.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. My math isn't that good. But
30-some years. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So it's either going to be the sending unit or the fuel pump, and you certainly wouldn't go to all the trouble of dropping the tank and not doing them as a package together.
Yeah.
And so I would say to him, I want you to bid the whole assembly, and I'll bring it in to you as low as I can because that's a real problem. You know, you got 20 gallons in the tank. Now I got four technicians trying to drop this tank onto the ground because one guy can't do it because it's full of gas.
And if they spill some on one of them, then we got to put him, hit him with a fire extinguisher, and then he smells like gas. And when he gets home, his wife kicks him back to the shop, and he spends the night on hoist number three. So in your particular case, I am 90% sure that you have a bad sender or a bad pump. If it were a newer model car, I'd probably go in and look for technical service bulletins in case this was a software problem or it needed an update somewhere. But I can guarantee you there ain't an update out there for your car. So it has to be
probably
in the tank.
Not.
All righty. Good luck to you, Terry.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir. Jim, you're up next. Jim, how can I help you?
Hey, good morning, Mark. How are you today?
Good.
Hey, I've got a 2008 GMC 2500 HD Duramax diesel.
Okay.
And when it is not towing anything, it always, the temperature gauge always stays at 210. I have never had a problem with it overheating at all. I am pulling a newer trailer with GVW of about just shy of 10,000 pounds.
Okay.
And lately, whether it's 50 degrees out or 118 degrees out, when I'm climbing some of those hills, that temperature gauge is getting up there in the 245 range or so. And my tranny temp is running about 220, 223. It doesn't stay there for very long, but it just kind of concerns me because I never had the temperature get that high. Normally, the highest it would get be maybe 225, 230.
Okay.
But this is a newer trailer and it's a little heavier, so I don't know if that's the problem or.
Well, there is no problem. There is no problem.
Okay.
The temperatures that you're citing, I mean, I'll take 10 on the top. I'll take 15 on the top end, and I don't have any problem with that. In your goal post, you have two, you know, you have a post to your left and a post to your right, then you have a center mark on your GMC. And your truck should run between half and three quarters all the time. Now, we're still a quarter, well, we're not a quarter, but we're about an eighth of an inch plus at the three quarter mark from the red zone. Under no circumstances should you get into the red zone. If you get into the red zone, pull off the side of the road, turn on your flashers, and put it in a neutral and bring the idle up, and let's circulate some coolant and stuff. But your transmission...
It doesn't really have a red zone. The center mark on it is 210, and the high mark on it is 260.
Okay.
And then the split between that, obviously, is 235. There's no red zone in any of that. It just gets above the 235. I know it's in the 240, 245 range. And that's why it's getting close to that 260 mark, and I try to keep that, you know, below that, but I try to keep it below the 235 mark.
I don't know if you're going to be able to.
It runs consistently all day long at 210. I mean,
but you're comparing two different things here. You're comparing two different things here. You can't have it both ways. I'm telling you again, 235 to 260 doesn't bother me. I run my trucks that hot.
Okay.
And I have a diesel. And I haul horses, and I haul bigger trailers than you got. So I'm just telling you, there's a reason it's running hot. It's not going wild on you. You're not seeing smoke come from underneath the hood. There's nothing going on. And if you don't believe me, here's what you do: go in and Google normal transmission temperatures. Now, we know water boils at 212. When we add coolant to it, we add another 30 to 40 pounds before it turns to a vapor. So you take 212 and you add 40 to it, you're at 252. Now, if we go to 50% coolant, we're well past 260. Then we apply pressure to it and we get 1 to 2 pounds of pressure and even raises it up even higher. So we're not going to turn the coolant or whatever's in your radiator to a vapor until you're way past the 260 mark. So I don't know. I've never seen a GM without the red mark on it. I believe you, but you have an explanation. You got a big trailer, and you're flirting with 260. I say no harm, no foul. So I appreciate you calling me, but I think the thing and your transmission temperature and your engine coolant temperature are going to mirror one another. So they're both pretty much the same thing. So they're both going to be the same number almost all the time. If you're going to abuse your transmission, you'll see a difference there, but I wouldn't worry about a 20-degree difference. I'd worry about a 40-degree difference. That means you're abusing the transmission. So that time, you pull your gear down, you back off the throttle a little bit, drop 10 miles an hour off your speed, and you're fine. Thank you very much. Chris, you're up next. Chris, how are you?
Hey, Mark. Hey, you're my favorite techie, Dan, let me tell you.
Thank you.
I got a quick question and another quick question in case the first one is real quick.
Okay.
A little enhancement that I discovered with a friend of mine who was a mechanic, more recent mechanic. I go back into the late 70s as a mechanic and worked for Mercedes. But he said, "Okay, let me get that thing out of there." I said, "What's that?" He said, "The screen in front of the map sensor, the airflow sensor." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." And he just took the thing out. Now he said, "I take it out in the parking lot and step on the gas. I smoked my tires. I could not believe the difference." Okay. Now I ran that truck for probably another 100,000 miles. Never had any difficulty with it. It never hurt the mileage that I was able to detect. But I just thought that was an amazing enhancement. And then when I put a MagnaFlow on it, I got even more power at it. Now, there I lost a little bit of mileage. But, the other question that I had, and the reason I called in, is whatever happened to Teflon? As soon as Slick 50 came out, I started using it because I remember what GM had done with the Chevy Vega. They used cast iron blocks that they just bored out, aluminum blocks that they just bored out and never put sleeves in. But they coated the boards with Teflon, and they would run for 40 or 50,000 miles before they would start smoking.
None of that's true.
Remember those? Huh?
None of that's true.
What, on the
Chevy Vegas?
On the little Chevy Vega.
Yeah, no, not that. I mean,
because when they would go bad, we would have to resleeve them.
Well, resleeving them is fine. Teflon burns in the combustion chamber. So how are you gonna line the inside of a sleeve on a cylinder and with Teflon, and here's another problem.
I thought they did it like go ahead.
Here's another problem. I've been involved in this Teflon issue since 1976. Do you know what the filter micron is? Do you know what the average oil filter micron catch is? And the answer is 20 microns,
really
20 millionths of a meter. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The Teflon molecules and the Teflon particles are three times that big. So if they get into the combustion chamber, they burn. If they don't get into the combustion chamber, they stay three times as big. You put Teflon in your motor, you instantaneously, it all goes to your filter, and there's nothing else that's good about it. So this whole QMI and all of those big Teflon things were just a big marketing joke. Everybody in the oil industry, and I'm an oil expert, everybody knew that. Now today, if you add that to your engine oil, you're going to have problems. Let's go back to your mass airflow sensor. The screen in front of your mass airflow sensor has nothing to do with nothing. Your mass airflow sensor is a small piece of wire that might be a quarter of an inch long or less. And we heat that up to red hot. And all we're doing is running airflow across that little wire. And so if there's no airflow, then the wire glows high, but the amp draw is not very high. But we start blowing hard, big air volume through that, then it takes more amps to keep that wire lit. So I am at a complete loss to explain why you could burn your tires after taking what effectively is a bug screen off the mass airflow sensor. So
it looks like a beehive.
Yeah, I understand that, but there's no more air that motor can draw at wide open throttle than that beehive can offer it. And even if they did, and they said this thing has a 10 CFM, and the beehive is 12, if the motor's capable of only 10, and the beehive is capable of delivering 12, the motor's only going to take 10. So I don't, you know, but I'll tell you what. Goody from Goody's Mercedes-Benz is already trying to call me.
2 minutes.
I never did it on a Mercedes. I did it on two Chevy S10s that I had.
Oh, okay.
You know, the 4.3.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I would never touch a Mercedes like that. No way, not now. Yeah. Oh, they're too advanced.
Yeah,
I open the hood and I run away.
Yeah, well, I'm with you. I open the hood. They got so much plastic on there, it takes you an hour just to get the plastic off to get to where you want to be. So,
yeah, hey, where's the motor?
Yeah. The Teflon idea was from the 70s. QMI started that, and then there was some people that put Teflon in their oil because that helped them market their oil. So there was a big change. But I am an expert in Chevron and in Valvoline, and I was around Mobil back in the 70s, and Mobil was terribly upset about this Teflon idea, and I'm quite sure, I can't speak for them, but I'm quite sure they dabbled in that. They thought about it, but they never pulled the trigger. Yeah. Mobil's big problem back in the 70s was, is they told everybody with Mobil 1 that they could go 25,000 miles, they bought lots of motors because of that stupid idea. So anyway, I got to run, Chris. Thank you very much. Hey, Eric, I don't have time to take you, but I want you to send me an email because I'm going to sit here and wait for it. Mark@MarkSalem.com. Eric, Mark with a K, @MarkSalemLikeTheCigarette.com. If you'll send me an email on your iPhone, then I'm going to call you back. If you'll send me your phone number, I'll call you back, but I'm calling from a blocked line. They make me call from a blocked line, but I'll call you right back. I feel bad that I didn't get you, Eric, so I'm telling you now. Just send me an email, give me your phone number, and I'll call you right back. Jeremy, thanks for spending this afternoon with me, and everybody else, thanks for spending your afternoon with me. We'll be back next Saturday at 10 o'clock here on KKNT, and we're talking about cars, and specifically your cars. So, and my email address, mark@marksalem.com, it's yours as well. Call me if you need me. I'll see you next Saturday.